Welcome to the Passport Play Podcast with Jonathan Lord. My guests this episode, Gary Belsky and Neil Fine, are founding partners of the editorial consulting firm Ellen Road Partners and the authors of the new book On the Origins of Sports, the Early History and Original Rules of Everybody's Favorite Games.
Okay, so the first thing I want to know is you guys have partnered together now for some time. Written books before, done other things. What took you so long to write this book? Because as I was going through it, it just felt so natural to me, as I'm sure it did both of you.
Don't you need to introduce us?
Oh, I do that before.
Oh, you know, like pre-production.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so we can now introduce you and then go back, or we can just...
Keep going in the conversation?
Sure.
I don't need to be introduced because I know who I am and I know who Neil is and I now know who you are. So yeah. I don't need that.
So probably what I'll end up doing is I'll go back and I'll say, the first voice you will hear that is not mine was Gary's.
Okay. So what took us so long? Well, we had other things to do. Neil invented a magazine called ESPN and then he had to hire me 6 issues in and then I had to work on that magazine and then the two of us had to... work with a lot of other people to make the magazine good and hopefully great, and then we ended up running the magazine. And then we had to leave the magazine when they moved all of our operations to Bristol, Connecticut, which is where ESPN is headquartered. And then we had to start a business in which we advise media organizations on how they do what they do, meaning make TV shows or make podcasts or make magazines or books or videos or websites. And then we had to get a client. We had to meet some people at a book publishing company called Artisan. And they asked us for ideas to reach male audiences because most of their very beautiful books are aimed at female book buyers. They do a lot of design books, a lot of cookbooks. They really like the idea of a physical book. They want to make beautiful objects. And so we had some ideas, and this was one of them, and they liked it. And to be honest with you, we had Neil and I in previous books and in... our time at ESPN, the magazine, we dipped into old rules periodically, like looked at them, published a couple of them without any kind of fanfare, just sort of put them in a rules issue. You know, we were doing a modern rules issue. But we suggested this. I don't think we necessarily thought it was our strongest idea. The people at Artisan, the publisher whose name is Leah Ronan and our editor whose name is Shoshana Guttmeier, they immediately clicked to it. They're sports fans, casual sports fans, and they actually saw, I think, this is fair to say, the possibilities of the book to be as interesting as it turned out to be quicker than we did. We realized
it. We were just making it up as we go along, really. And by making it up, I mean we stole ideas because we hardly ever have our own ideas anymore. It's been a long time. And this was, like Gary said, something that we've done a little bit of over time. We just thought it was one of many things that we presented to them, and they seemed to like it best.
They got very excited by it.
It's amazing to me that it was unique, too. It was authentic. I mean, I'm sure there are others that maybe just focus on one sport.
Well, that's exactly it.
And what this does is it focuses on... all sports, or as many sports as you can fit into.
There's a few, we can talk about how we chose which sports to put in the book, but there's a few distinguishing things about this. One is, there's probably a handful of famous sports rules that have been out there and that people talk about. They're in our, you know, most of them are in our book. All of them probably are in our book. Nobody's ever combined all the rules into one book, the old, original, what you might call the launching pad rules. So that was unusual. Two, even the books that sort of, there's a few books that focus on the specific rules of the specific sports, they didn't really annotate them in the way that we did. We had this sort of idea to take an approach in which we would not just publish the rules and give a backstory to how they came about, but we would also go through them and... sort of say, first of all, translate some of the words, because some of the references in these rules are incomprehensible to modern sports fans. But we would also talk about significant things in those rules and either what they meant then or how they evolved. So that's also unusual. But what's interesting about this is what surprised us, I think, and Neil is always a little more conservative than I am about taking on projects, was when we suggested this, they were like, how many rules do you think you could do? And I think at the time we said, I don't know, maybe like a dozen, maybe, you know, because we knew about six or seven of these rules that existed. And they said, and even at a dozen, I think Neil was a little bit cautious. And they said, well, it'd probably be better with like, you know, at least a couple dozen. And I'm the youngest of five children. Neil's the oldest of his siblings. So we played to our birth order. I was like, sure, we could do that. And it turns out we found basically about 20. And that was the criteria. So what I mean is we don't have anything of substance about Formula One racing, because when you look at open wheel racing, there's no obvious set of rules that experts look at and say, that's where Formula One open wheel racing began. But we have NASCAR, because NASCAR in 1947, they, you know, invented itself, and Bill Franz invented it, and they wrote up a set of rules, right? So
yeah, if badminton or
lacrosse,
any of those, you know, surfing, any of those sports had rules that we could have found, it would have ended up in the book. We just couldn't find those. And if when we do the sequel on the Origins of Sports 2, then we'll put those in.
So I'm guessing, Neil, you don't have similar reservations anymore as far as being able to provide the kind the kind of quantity
I'm still not sure it's all right.
That goes back to birth order.
Maybe.
He's kidding, of course. What's interesting is we're talking actually with a couple of production companies about maybe doing an episodic, you know, TV show off of this. And what we explained to them was you could actually... So we also did these, what we thought were very... our team sort of wrote these very accessible pop histories of each sport. Like, you know, there are whole books written about the history of baseball or football or basketball. We wanted to tell that history in 1,000 words, essentially.
And it's only the history up to the rules.
Up to the rules, right.
Kids as well.
And you could... what we realize now is we could write those histories for lots of other sports that we don't have... that there aren't original rules for, right? So, you know, we could write a history of competitive surfing or of lacrosse or of, you know...
Curling,
anything really. And we mention a lot of those sports elsewhere in the book where we can, because, as you know, because you have the physical copy in front of you, there's each sport has this, like, very interesting, we think, sort of illustrated section that talks about some aspect of the sport. But the criteria to be in this was it had to be... there had to be original rules that either... other experts, or once in a while, we decided were the launch pad for the modern game as we know it. The best example of that being American football, in that there were rules being written for a game that was thought of as American football from about the 1870s. But we decided that that game, even though the line of scrimmage was invented, we decided that game still seemed much more like rugby than not. And so our decision as to what was created the modern rules of football, the modern game of football, was the 1906 Spalding rules that introduced the forward pass. So there's debate about that. We're perfectly comfortable making the argument that we make. And there are other people that think the modern game of football didn't really even begin for another 20 years when the forward pass really became more common. Because
in most of the cases, the original rules are pretty self-evident, but in rules like boxing, I think boxing, like the Marquess of Queensberry rules, is not the rules we use. We use the ones that preceded them.
Right, two versions
two
before,
versions
actually.
Before. And in baseball, there's a little bit of a...
we use the Knickerbocker rules, but there's a...
In 1840-something instead of the 1857 rules. But it's you know... in the weeds where the changes are.
But the smart play by you in this book is that by focusing on the origins of the rules, you kind of avoid the discussion about the evolution of rules. Not
correct.
To say that you don't talk about it, and you do a lot of infographics, a lot of pictographs that talk about the evolution of certain things within
mm-hmm.
the sports. But it struck me as pretty smart of you to not get a lot into how rules change over time and also how they differ depending on leagues, because then it gets a little murkier and it might be harder for people to consume, especially when you're just giving like 1,000 or so words and then moving on to another
right.
sport.
We made reference to stuff like that. Like rugby, we mentioned that there are different kinds of rugby and we kind of gave a phrase to distinguish the two, but we didn't go into in much detail what distinguishes rugby union from rugby league.
Yeah, that was both a narrative choice and also a business choice that I think we sort of recognized and that our publishers were also very smart about, which is the narrative choice was exactly, it just starts getting very complicated and you start telling, and also other people have told the history of most of these sports to great effect and more detail. And this book is not big enough to accommodate the full history of all sports, all 21 sports. It would be a 2,000-page book. The other reason was that for the most part, this book is somewhat inured against time overtaking it, right? So yeah. There's a chance that somebody will discover earlier rules for the game of golf. Now, we publish the rules of the Gentleman of Leith or the Gentleman of Edinburgh. They're the oldest rules. The truth is, I'm sure there were rules of golf before that, but nobody can find them. So there's a chance with any of these that somebody might find an earlier version of rules that created a modern game. But for the most part, that our publishers are hoping, and so are we, this will continue selling because it doesn't get overtaken by time.
The question of time is one that I was fixated on as I was reading the book, because we live in a time when I think a lot of people complain nowadays about that there are oftentimes too many rules associated with games, and it affects our consumption of those games. You know, I'm thinking in terms of what it's like to watch baseball nowadays, or what it's like to try to play golf according to the certain, you know, decorum and etiquette of the game. As sports fans, do you find yourselves kind of torn in both directions with the rules of the game? I mean, this certainly wasn't what you were intending to cover in this, but in writing about the rules, did it just almost feel like overwhelming to an extent?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, I think the original rules of baseball, there's like 18 or 19 of them, and now there's an entire book with sub-chapters of different levels of rules. And what's weird to me is that a lot of stuff that seems obvious stuff wasn't even covered in the real rules, or things that you would think would be. Like, in baseball, or in most sports, there's no penalties for, like, punching a guy in the face, right? I mean, that should be... That would have been the first rule I wrote if I was making up a new sport.
No punching people in the face?
No punching people in the face, unless it's boxing. Or hockey.
Yeah, I would also suggest that if you look at the rules of football, they're pretty involved even in 1906. The rules of bowling also. And what was interesting about these rules, all of them almost, was in rare cases, really in no cases, with the exception, I guess, of ultimate frisbee, they weren't really creating, and I guess Naismith basketball, they weren't for the most part creating sports out of whole cloth. They were codifying games that have already been played. And so some of these rules reflect circumstances or happenings that clearly the people who are writing the rules were trying to avoid. So, you know, in the original rules of bowling, they talk about what happens if somebody doesn't pay his dues to the club. And it's like, well, clearly somebody must have, you know, stiffed a club on his dues, and they didn't want, you know, other clubs to sort of let that person come in. In the original rules of rugby, they deal with how do you rule the three trees in the middle of the field. Well, that was very specific to the three trees in the rugby school close. Rugby is the name of a school, and the close was the field that they played on, and there were three giant, I think, elm trees there. And so they didn't think they were writing a rules that were going to launch a global sport. They thought they were writing down rules for people who were going to play them when they came to rugby school.
And who are already playing them. In cricket, there's cricket. They don't even tell you how to score because they know that everybody already knows how to do that. So they're talking about the parameters of fields and things, but they're not even talking about the basic premise of the game.
Right. They're trying to clear up oftentimes things that people were arguing about when people who didn't know each other or didn't play with each other regularly were coming together to play, right? A lot of these have to do with the nature of society. Like, people started to be able to travel. People started to be able to, you know, play. One parish could play another parish. One town could play another town. In theory, one college that could be hundreds of miles away from another college could play each other in a game. And so they were trying to sort of eliminate the potentials for fighting on areas where clearly they had fights before when they tried to merge.
Yeah, that was one of the aspects of your book that I found myself wanting more of, which is the cultural aspect of the origin story. You know, I'm fascinated by, as I'm sure you guys are too, you know, how these sports begin and how they're indicative of the people who are creating them.
Yes.
I think that is just so fascinating. And because of the, you know, the space, the space you've given yourselves to cover all the different sports, it wasn't really possible for this type of book. But, you know, if we could just talk for a second about how sports really truly are indicative of the cultures and the peoples that are creating them. I mean, you can learn so much about a group of people by looking at the games they play.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, it came down. I mean, it came down to boredom or extra time.
Right, but what? But which sport? Right, but which sports and how the rules of, you know, evolved certainly are reflections of the particular individual cultures. Right, I'm not sure the British ever come up with American football because, you know, they're not quite as litigious. They're much less likely to just sort of.
Well, they're more genteel in general.
Well, yeah, they weren't likely, you know, even though the YMCA was the, you know, the Young Men's Christian Association, you know, was the embodiment of this muscular Christianity movement that began in England, they were not nearly as inclined towards violence as Americans were. So the whole nature of football, even from the 1860s when it split from rugby, the British just wouldn't have come up with that game, I truly believe.
Except that they invented boxing.
Right. But everybody was punching.
I've talked with Iago Colas, who is a professor at the University of Michigan. He wrote this book called Ball Don't Lie. It's about the history, the sociology of basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a lot, and we talked a lot about the foundations of basketball and how, you know, when Naismith or the early rule writers of the game of basketball were writing a sport or were designing a sport to be enjoyed and played for the most part by, you know, middle-class white guys. Mm-hmm. And therefore, a lot of the language that is written in the rule writing is written so that it is the embodiment of qualities of that specific group of people in society.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the game evolves and the players evolve and become more diverse, that language is often used to describe one type of player more than another.
Mm-hmm.
So you get into this fascinating development of American culture and society through the evolution of rules and the language of rules in the sport of basketball, and I just find it fascinating, and I do find a correlation with what you've written here as well.
Yeah, I don't think we got anything terrifically wrong. There were lots of things we didn't explore as much as we could. Even the gambling, which we talked about for the most part in cricket and in baseball. I think, first of all, in both those sports, you could write at length about the role of gambling in the development of sports and the development of rules. And in other sports, doubtless, there was also a huge influence of gambling and betting that we didn't get to, just because if you're going to write basically 1,000 words, you have to tell certain stories over other stories. There was also, I think, in general, there was just sort of this, you know, a sense that that the times when these rules were codified are almost always reflected in those rules, not just the culture, but the time. So, for example, the rules of ultimate, you know, which was invented by Joel Silver, who ended up going on to become a major Hollywood producer.
The Hollywood producer?
Yeah. Yeah. He was writing these in high school in the 60s when there was a lot of idealism going on and people were rebelling against this idea that you sort of, you know, of kind of the structures of society. And so ultimate, you know, still has at its core this somewhat naive hope that people will be able to police themselves.
But they were in the original rules, it was like the field was kind of wherever and the score was kind of whenever.
Everything was on competitor's honor. And to the most part, it worked for the, you know, it was a self-selection bias, right? Same as golf. For the most part, the people who, you know, I play golf, I play football regularly on a Sunday morning in which we're always arguing about rules. It's a very competitive game. There's lots of moments in which you sort of wonder, I need to be careful about this because some of the people in my league will listen. But there are lots of moments in which you're sort of like, you're towing the line of whether or not it's there was a violation or something really was in bounds or out of bounds. But it's funny, in golf, that same person, me, if I'm in the woods and it would be much more convenient for me to kick my ball out from a tree, and I just won't do it because I'll just think like, who am I fooling? I'm only fooling me in a weird way because you're playing against yourself. And so the whole, you know, golf is a game that kind of, for some reason, inspires a lot of people to, most of the people who play it, to kind of self-police in a way that you don't in other sports.
Yeah, but I mean, I play golf, but I would take a slightly different take on that, and that there are other sports where you ask to self-police. It's just that I think golf gets most of the publicity and notoriety.
Well, aside from ultimate, which ones?
Okay, well, pick up basketball. I mean, pick up basketball. There are you are asked to call your own fouls.
No, you're asked to. You're not asked to call. You're asked to call your own fouls, but you're not asked to. You're allowed to call your own fouls on you, but nobody sort of expects you to. If I, you know, slap your hand while you're shooting and you don't say anything, I don't go, hey, I fouled you there. I should accept it when you say that you were fouled, but I don't call it myself.
And a lot of times people do. I mean, that's the nature of, you know.
Yeah, when it's very obvious.
Yeah,
I think there's a
go to the basket and somebody wraps their arms around you. Or,
sure.
Or when you're trying to get a shot up and you kick someone in the testicles.
Sure.
Oh, wait,
who doesn't do that?
Who doesn't do that? In fact, we can talk
about it. Also not in the rules.
Also not in the rules, but perhaps it's just an accepted breaking of the rules that should be enforced.
Yeah, could be. Also, there was tackling that they were worried about.
Yeah, in the original rules of basketball, it was much rougher in some ways than it is now because you would have to...
The last person to touch the ball before it went out of bounds.
Got to keep the ball, so people would tackle and throw people back.
Well, if Adam Silver is accepting some sort of addition to the current NBA rule book, I put in, you know, rule number whatever, we're going to call it 1001-A. One player may not kick another player in the testicles when...
Apparently it's illegal because he didn't get suspended, so...
That's right. But this does segue nicely to the question about unwritten rules. You could have, and you'd write volumes of books
we did magazine issues about that.
Unwritten rules. So you've done it before. And I find that people are infatuated with the unwritten rules. And I don't know why that is. I don't know in your experience why it made for, you know, marketable magazine issues. What is it about the unwritten rules of these games that fascinates people so in our culture?
I think it's the insideriness of it. People, especially to the extent that people like to, like clubs and either want to belong to the club or want to not belong to the club. But I think you, especially professional clubs, there's this idea of, like, the more you know. We did them because we thought we were giving people an inside look at something that they cared about. And people just generally want to know what's going on with things that they care about. I don't think it's about the rules themselves. I don't think it's about the particular thing that happens in your brain with a rule that's unwritten versus written, although maybe it's a little bit of it, right? Like, I'm sure with Neil has children, and with your son, I'm sure there are moments in which you've told him, like, you don't do that, right? And you probably feel good even not just letting him know that you don't do that, but in telling him.
Yeah, but even that's changed. I mean, that's a societal thing, too, because there are a lot of things that I think old school baseball players, for instance, would never consider that now is pretty much okay. I mean, the old guys think that Bryce Harper is a jackass. I mean,
but kids love him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the most popular player, one of the most popular players in the game. Right. But I do think
there's a distinction to be made between the unwritten rules of behavior and the unwritten codes of play. I do think there's a difference.
Right, because that's what it sounds like we're circling around. When we talk unwritten rules, it seems like we mostly are focused on unwritten rules of behavior, not necessarily the unwritten rules that govern
the double play is the perfect is game. The phantom touch or tag in the double play is sort of like...
They call it the neighborhood play.
Right, which is, you know, everybody kind of... And that's not about behavior, that's about...
But even that, it's harder and harder to do that now, too, because with instant replay, you're allowed to check.
Yeah, but they're often not... that's not checked nearly as often, even in playoffs, as you would imagine.
I
only when something else happens.
I predict that there will come a time when it will, because it's going to cause it's going to make the difference between a win or a loss.
They will actually put a circle around the base, and in double plays they'll say.
But then it's not an unwritten rule anymore. Right?
No, I'm saying right. So you're right.
But that is an instance where a rule is being broken. I mean, this is not even an unwritten rule.
Yes, but
the rule is being broken. It's just that the people who are entrusted with enforcing the rules are choosing not to enforce.
Everybody on both sides knows it
because everybody has a. And the reason for that developing was not so that people could get outs easier. It was because there was a presumption that if there was too much focus played by the pivot person at second base on actually putting his foot there, people would get hurt.
Hurt.
Right.
Right. Well, now they've eliminated much of that with the new rules to protect players, safety around the bag. I was watching a baseball game the other night, and here's another interesting one that came up. And this is a written rule, but it's just not enforced. And so I don't know what we can call this. It's clear it's a written rule. They were talking about how third base coaches never, ever, ever stand in the designated coach's box. And this, I think he was for the Red Sox. He was up against the Cleveland Indians dugout. And that was to give himself, obviously, you know, an angle for the player running second base to, you know, to round third base. And the announcers said that he is breaking a rule, and it's up to the manager of the opposing team to say something. And then that coach must go back in the box for the rest of the game. However, then his third base coach must also return to the
box. Right, there's a little bit of and you're wondering why isn't the umpire calling it?
Right. So if this is a rule that
why isn't the umpire calling it?
If this is a rule that is being broken, and you have to see how far this guy that was down the line, he was basically in the Indians dugout, and it's up to the manager to enforce that rule. That just seems to me as if self-policing has gone a bit too far. Shouldn't the people in charge of enforcing the rules be the ones that say?
But then the question is, what's the point of that rule ultimately? Anyway, does it give you an unfair advantage? Is it
stealing signs?
Well, stealing signs, yes, but that's not a stealing signs thing. That's just
could be. I mean, he's now at a perfect angle to look.
That would be interesting. We didn't get into that obviously because the original rules of baseball don't talk about where the coach stands. But I wonder whether or not the idea that they had to be in a particular designated area had to do with that, or it just had to do with, you know, chaos or confusion or something or interference as opposed to Stein's. I actually don't know what the origins are of where the coach's box is.
Safety, probably. Do you think a lot of it maybe came down to stealing signs? I mean,
well, that's different. Yeah. But whether stealing signs and safety are two very different things. That's what I don't know. And there's a lot of things in which there's. But you're right that the idea of the flexibility within the code is sort of appealing, right? Like, nobody minds, and in fact, people are often intrigued by the ways in which hockey coaches will ask for a stick measurement, right? That in the end, on every team, there's always a couple of players who push the regulations about how far your stick blade can be bent because it helps you do
things. Or how much air is in a football.
Right, helps you do things with the puck.
But what's that called? That's called gamesmanship on behalf of the opposing team. But that's just a rule.
It's called cheating is what it's called. I mean, technically. I mean, there are rules and you're breaking them. That's cheating.
So why does society in many cases choose to direct their ire towards the people who are calling out those for committing an infraction rather than those that are committing an infraction? Well, if you look at
half of anybody who's watching is calling out the person who's calling it. The other half are calling out the person who's doing it. It depends on who you're rooting for.
But it's like,
I mean, Patriots fans think that Tom Brady did nothing wrong and everybody else in America thinks that he did. Whether they care or not whether they think it had a fundamental effect on the game is a different issue, but...
Well, going back to baseball, another one of those rules is, you know, putting foreign objects on baseballs. And how when it gets cold, you know, a lot of players will put something on the bill of their cap or their pants to try to add a little bit more stick. And it's widely accepted that both hitters and pitchers are tolerant of that because it can lead to safety. You got more control on the ball when it gets cold, so there you're going to have more accurate pitching. But they are technically putting a foreign substance on the ball, yet it doesn't. The umpires aren't going to say anything unless a manager comes out and says, "Hey."
But isn't there also like if the weather gets like doesn't the umpire come out before the game on the cold night and say it's okay to do? You know,
I thought an umpire came out. You can go to your hand.
But by the way, there's two different things. They're not putting a foreign substance on the ball specifically. They're putting a foreign substance on their hands. Like they're not trying. They're not saying you can then put a glob of something on a baseball. I think there's an understanding within the people who play this game of that difference. Like when somebody's pine tarring up their hands or rosining up their hands, there's a way in which it's just clear they're trying to get better grip, which I don't think anybody has an issue with, as opposed to putting something on the ball and oftentimes now they would more likely cut rather than add, right? They try to, you know, cut the leather. And so, you know, there's nuances. And for the, you know, baseball is particularly prone to this, or at least in the way that always happens, there's something about the sport that makes all this more magnified. Baseball's also weird in that there's minimums for the outfield and specifications for the infield, but we seem to like the fact that some outfields are bigger, some outfields are not. Not only are they bigger, but they're regularly shaped. I mean, the Astros, when they built a new stadium, not only did they make their outfield oddly shaped at its perimeter, but they put a bump. I mean, I don't know anything like that in sports. It's anything else.
Unique to baseball. If you think about every other sport, there is uniformity as far as the size of the field or the court, the ball, things like that. But with baseball, you're right, the dimensions are different. One of the things, getting back to the origins of these rules and these sports, I wonder if rulemaking is different in this day and age because of, you know, commercialism, television, the fact that oftentimes sports are crafted to be digested on, you know, many platforms. That I don't know if that was a concern of the people
not.
Of the people who, but
it
so
was
what
for
I'm
the, it
interested
was for the almost all of that until I would say the football rules. In our book, there's 21 rules we have in there. Until football, which was actually had a lot of thought about people observing the game for a whole bunch of reasons. Teddy Roosevelt was the one that spurred it because it was an outcry against the violence in football, which was killing people. Until that moment, I think it's safe to say, I think it's safe to say that for the most part, the rules were meant to help the people who were playing the game, except that I think a lot of the codification in baseball and cricket was also done to make things less friction for gamblers, right? They wanted to be able to sort of know what they were betting on. But for the most part, the rules were written for the people who were playing.
Yeah, I think that was even then it was secondary, though. I think it was almost always about the people playing.
And so it wasn't about the audience. It wasn't about the fans. And so that's one thing that I do think is interesting now when you talk about rules. And if we're going to make new rules, I think a lot of the rules that are created now are made to satisfy the tendencies of an audience. Baseball, it's like...
The three-point line in basketball.
But that makes sense because they should be the most important constituency because the nature of the game is played. For the most part, even in the early days of professional sports... And that you could argue that that's actually 3,000 years ago during the Greek times when people were clearly professional athletes and there was sponsorship, not for nothing. You know, olive press makers and, you know, wine makers. Olive oil makers and winemakers sponsored, you know, Greek athletes in the Olympics. But for the most part, the most important constituency was the people who were playing it. And it's not the most important constituency now because that's the audience because that's where the money comes from.
And there's nothing, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's just, I found it to be a difference, you know, how it would have been very interesting to go back and see how different the sport of, let's say, baseball or golf would have been at its basic foundation if the audience were a consideration. You know, would golf have had more rules in place to ensure that the game was played in a speedier fashion?
Golf is an awfully similar game to what was being played 200 or 300 years ago.
Yeah,
by the way, I don't think they've done much. Even to the extent that they've changed the rules, which has a lot to do with equipment, and changed the courses to sort of make them longer, that's just actually a function of making it remain competitive for the competitors less than it is about the audience.
My point, though, is that if golf could take a mulligan, would they have put more rules in place that would ensure for swifter rounds so that...
That would make it more fun for people like me to watch as opposed to you.
Well, the single thing that, you know, the best argument for golf not being a sport is the thing that if they somehow managed to figure it out would be make the game more interesting, which is, we were just recently interviewed for Newsweek's doing a big story about what's a sport, right? And we went back and forth, and the guy, and I had no problem with poker being in our book and poker being considered a sport, because I actually think there's a physical component to it, and there's winners and losers, etc. But actually the guy made a really interesting point to me that I thought was, I'd never really thought about, which is that he goes, well, in poker at least you can play defense. He goes, in golf you can't play defense. And in auto racing, by the way, you can play defense, right? You can try to, and in golf there is... With the exception of playing well, so you psych somebody out, there's absolutely, you know, that he was arguing it's not a sport because there's no way to play defense.
Huh.
Now, having said that, neither is archery. I don't think anybody wonders if archery is a sport.
Yeah, you could discount half the Olympic Games, perhaps.
Right, but those are, but you can certainly, you're not allowed to interfere in running, right?
You can
cut people off, but you can't.
Track and field, there's no defense.
Right.
The question of what is
those certainly are sports in our mind, or at least they're competitions.
The question of what is a sport is a fascinating one to me, because as I was reading through this, it's like, well, I think of kickball as a sport, but I think of it as a sport best enjoyed when there aren't as many rules. So one of the things that I wanted to ask was, is it a sport if there are no rules? Right? Do the rules make it the sport, or is there some other element to it that makes it a sport?
Well, in defense of Nicholas Seuss, who invented kickball, The only reason he had rules, he didn't have that many of them, was because he was actually inventing a game out of whole cloth, right? He was not trying to make it be very, rule-bound. He was just actually trying to explain a game to...
That's true, but you're right. I mean, it's some version of chaos until you have rules, whether they're written or unwritten. Like even, kill the guy with the ball or whatever that you play on a playground. You could argue it's a sport because people know what you can and can't do.
But it felt more like a game, right? I remember we used to play kill the guy with the ball a lot when we were in when I was in grade school. And the reason why you started talking about rules, which you inevitably did, was because there's always one kid who was annoying and just thought you could just keep running around the school. And you're like, well, that's now becomes a race, not the game. And the whole idea of
it's out of fairness.
Right.
I would argue that getting back to today's day and age, I have two young kids, and it's important to
me.
Are they
cute?
They're very cute.
By the way, today's day and age, it's not like we're 1,000 years old.
Are they 30?
We were kids recently.
Are they smart?
Are they smart? Well, they're as smart as their parents. So
that's a good answer, actually.
So maybe we've set the bar high or low. I don't know. One of the things that we always encourage is get outside, play. And, my 5-year-old gravitates towards, games where there are rules and scores and things like that. And I always have to constantly remind him, no, just go out and play. And because there's great merit there in playing, but also in being surrounded by other people who are playing a similar thing and kind of coming up with rules together, rules to kind of self-govern and self-police.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that isn't done as much anymore with young kids, because as soon as they can walk, they get in leagues,
mm-hmm.
and those leagues have rules, and then it's kind of out of our hands. And in a way, I kind of lament and long to get back to the time when we were kids, right, and growing up, and there's just...
Yeah, well, we were kids at a different time than you were kids, because we're in our 50s, and I don't think you are in your 50s.
Wait a minute, you guys just gave me a hard time for...
Well, I gave you a hard time.
He gave me a hard time because he's self-conscious about being old.
Yeah, that's true.
But what I was going to say was, I'm sure Neil did, but I grew up, we played a couple of different versions, depending on where we were, of stickball, streetball, whatever the case, wall ball, whatever the case may be. And they all had their own, different sets of rules, mostly based on geography and things like that.
Yeah. What is it about this country that is so, I don't know what the word is to use, but we refuse to accept the standards or the interests of what other people from around the world, with sports. The two most popular sports from your book were, what was it? It was rugby and cricket.
Soccer.
Sorry. Soccer and cricket, right? Those are the two most popular sports.
Yeah, it depends on how you measure it. Participation, by the way, it's volleyball.
Volleyball.
It's soccer, then volleyball. More people play volleyball than play basketball.
So let's just go with soccer and cricket or volleyball. But these are sports here in the United States which are growing, but you wouldn't say that they're the most popular sports. The most popular sports in this country are sports that were created here that aren't played in other places around the world.
Baseball was created overseas.
We do argue it.
You do argue it. I mean, you take it.
It was.
Yeah. Well, that's the one of the things that was great about your book is that it wasn't Doubleday. I mean, you're not the first to say it. Others have. But again, I just to get to this point about why. Let's just say that America has interest to creation of different sports that are popular from around the world. I mean, what is that about?
Well, what's the metric system about and our refusal to adopt it? I just think it's about this idea of American exceptionalism, right?
So it does
It's probably a function of American insecurity deep down, but...
Yeah, it does go back to that. I just think it's interesting that what the world finds popular is not necessarily what is popular here, and I wondered if there was more to it as far as...
Well, it's also a little bit chicken and egg, because I assume that someday when America wins the World Cup, when the men win the World Cup, because apparently it's not even just what America thinks, but what American men think. But when the American men win the Soccer World Cup, it'll be a bigger deal, a bigger sport.
When is that going to happen?
Not in my lifetime. Maybe in yours, but not in my lifetime.
So there I go. There you go again. You're dating.
It's funny. Like, I just think it's a function of the American character, right? I'm always, until very recently, and even now still, it was very hard and arduous to move to America, to immigrate, right? It required boat trips and often escape, people had to have a lot of effort. So I often think the American character, literally our DNA, is overrepresented with two things. One is optimism, right? People who, my grandfather was the youngest of 14 on my dad's side. The other ones, about three of them came over in very difficult circumstances in the early part of the 20th century, and the others didn't. My grandfather was just a, you know, had a, was more optimistic and more of sort of kind of like, I'm going to figure this out, completely uprooting my life and going to a foreign country where I don't speak the language. So I think we overrepresent for optimism, which is evident in lots of things about the American character, but I think we also overrepresent in insecurity, right? A lot of the people who are leaving were like, I don't fit in here.
Well, they were kicked out.
Or they were kicked out. In either case, you were sort of deep down had this sort of sense of unworthiness or not belonging, which breeds insecurity, which for most people, especially optimistic people, what that translates into is a, we are awesome.
Yeah.
And we are only going to like the things that we don't need your stupid sports. We don't need your stupid measuring system.
If we're so awesome, then why haven't these other sports caught on around the world?
Well, some have. Basketball has.
Basketball has, but I would say that that's a slight outlier, right? I mean, baseball is not played at a high level.
Anywhere but Japan, Australia, China, South America.
Yeah, but nowhere near.
Well, nowhere near.
Correct, but it's growing.
Football, I mean, can you say that?
Volleyball.
I mean, they're trying, we're trying to export, we continue to try to export, but as a business decision, we continue to try to export football and baseball. And
but basketball. Volleyball is played, again, volleyball is probably the second most competitive team sport, most played, participated team sport after soccer.
And I wonder why that is, if it's just because of the accessibility.
It's not simple.
Yeah. Not because of the rules or the number of rules. I mean, getting back to the idea of rules, I mean, there are clear sets of rules when it comes to volleyball, but as far as the equipment goes and the space required,
that's right.
Maybe that's what makes it.
I think it's a simple, you know, soccer and volleyball are pretty simple, and basketball, but even soccer even more so, and volleyball even more so than basketball, are very simple games to sort of set up. Like, you don't even need a net, really, with volleyball. You just need sort of a height, and then you could have a string. And in soccer, obviously, you don't really even need a goal. You just need basically two things. You know, that's how most of us played when we were kids, right? And even basketball is a little bit more trickier, and that all the more so for hockey and football and baseball, where you need equipment and very specific, like, field parameters, et cetera.
Hockey's another one, but are we talking about field sizes, different field sizes? I mean, I know they're the court lengths and sizes differ depending on leagues, but with Olympic size rinks are bigger than, like, NHL.
But the shape doesn't differ in the way that baseball outfield borders. The shape is different.
The shape is different,
and nobody says, like, let's put a little mogul in the middle of our ice rink.
Yeah. Well, they did with the foundations of what was it, rugby, with the three elm trees.
Yes, but nobody else replicated that.
So you mentioned a sequel, hypothetically speaking, in the sequel to this book, what will be the sports that will be covered? Were there sports that you omitted from this first go-around here that you were just itching to write a little bit about? Give us a preview of what some of those might be.
We would have liked to have done horse racing, definitely, I think.
Yeah.
We would have liked to have done...
surfing.
Yeah, surfing.
Competitive surfing.
I'm fascinated by curling, because I don't get it.
How did that develop? Like, it's such a particular and nuanced sport. Right. It feels like an acquired taste.
It was surprising to us we couldn't find, you know, kind of like the original rules of that, because it feels very rules based in its own way.
So in the same way that we have a couple of sports in here that aren't physical to, you know, for the most part, which is poker and fantasy football, we wanted to include a couple of things that our publishers, just for their own reasons, or our editor sort of nixed, but we would, if we would do another book, which I don't think we will, the original story of Monopoly is actually, you know, a very interesting story. The game that was actually based on, really probably stolen from, a game called Tenant, which was actually an anti-capitalist board game that looks incredibly similar to Monopoly, and it's just, not only was it stolen, but it was turned into a pro-capitalist.
That was a great book. Have you read The Monopolist?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a Mary Pylon. That was a wonderful, wonderful book.
And I would also say, we found it's not the original rules, but it is the oldest rules. No, we didn't find it. They exist. But they exist. There's a poem from the 9th century, an Indian subcontinent poem, that basically details the history of chess is just a fascinating history, so I would have loved to have written about that, especially. What's fun is I don't know, wouldn't want to write a book about the history of chess, but I'd love to write a 1,000-word essay about it, right? Because that was what was fun about all this stuff, was like not having to sort of kind of trying to figure out what was the most important trends to sort of follow over 1,000 words. Also, I'm fascinated. Like, I'm a good backgammon player, but mostly because I understand that what most people in America play when they casually play backgammon is not remotely what backgammon is at a competitive level, which is it needs to be a betting game. It needs to be involved the doubling cube. If you play backgammon without the doubling cube, you basically just have to learn the rules and then understand kind of there's about 20 basic moves based on, and then you just have to, whoever gets the better rolls of the dice is going to win. It's the significance of backgammon, which is a 1,000 or 2,000 year old game, where the addition of the doubling cube in the 30s, 1930s, like the doubling cube didn't exist. It was just a past. It was like an.
Why then and there? Why the 1930s?
It was in New York in a club in which somebody sort of understood like what really is, you know, is that if you play backgammon and you pay attention to what happens, you understand that people get that confidence shifts with position, right? People play it and they start talking trash because they think they're in a really good place, and all of a sudden they have a couple bad rolls, they're stuck and they can't get out, and the other person, and so somebody must have realized that it was at those moments, those inflection points of confidence, where if you actually made people like, you want to bet? Do you want to bet that you're going to win? That people all of a sudden started, you know, that the game gets way more interesting, and then you can escalate that betting until all of a sudden you start playing for a penny a point, and you're playing for, you know, $8 a point or something like or more, depending on where you start.
I just like that now I know that there is trash talk in backgammon.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if I've learned one thing so far, I can now walk away comfortably knowing that there's trash talk in backgammon. I do want to ask you about where some of these rules came from. I know where they came from, but, I mean, are we talking about, like, you know, scrolls of parchment that are in archives somewhere?
The cricket rules are in sort of something that would very much look a little bit like, as they're on, I think the surviving rules are kind of on something parchmenty because they were written in 1724.
But are these other ones just preserved in Hall of Fame?
Basketballs that were typed out.
Just typed out on, like, onion skin paper.
Yeah. I think they might have been Naismith retyping them. Like, he did type them out. I don't know whether or not
it's pretty typey. It looks pretty.
It may not be the first one. It may have been something. He did 6 months later.
But
we don't have, so for example, the 1906 Spalding football rules, somebody might have written those down, but
right.
They were published in a athletic sporting guide,
and
so that's what we use.
And there's a chance.
But it was hard to find, by the way.
There's a chance that those rules that were published differ from the ones that were first written down.
Well, almost assuredly, because even the basket, so we explained in the book, even in some of the rules that we got that were published, there were typos. Like, it was clear that, and so, you know, that it was clear that they were just, you know, mistakes. And so those are the ones that we caught.
But again, it's funny that we're considering those, like, you know, holy writ, because the rugby rules were written by, you know,
15-year-olds.
Yeah, 15 and 16-year-olds. So what the hell do they know?
And yeah. they were again, oftentimes nobody was thinking that they were. So the Football Association rules, they were thinking that they were writing the rules, I think, for people who were playing at a very high level in London for the most part, which basically meant in England, right? So they thought that they were doing something that was going to have import, but they weren't necessarily thinking that they did not think they were writing something holy. They did not think they were writing something sacred. They thought they were writing a document that was practical. And so, yes, I'm sure that there were probably even people, when they finished writing down those rules that exist somewhere, of the Football Association rules, they're in a museum somewhere. I'm sure if some of the people who were there were like, no, that's not what we meant. Whatever, we'll deal with it later.
I mean, that said, though, you did have your hands on the original fantasy football rules.
Well, I had electronic. He,
oh, that's right.
And I'm pretty sure he must have. I'm pretty sure he must have retyped them.
I was interested about the fantasy football rules
because it wasn't a scan.
That went back a lot further than I thought it would have.
Well, we didn't discover that, but that was a scoop. Everybody, it was in the last 5 or 10 years, it's become known, probably the last 5 years. Morty Ain, who's the guy at ESPN, did sort of some of the best stories about this. It became known that fantasy football did not come after fantasy baseball, which most people thought, but rather preceded fantasy baseball as we know it by about 18 years. Having said that, nobody knew about it, and it didn't expand at all beyond a very small group of people in the Bay Area in California. So the fantasy football as we know it evolved from people who were playing fantasy baseball as we know it, which was invented by Dan Okrent and 12 other guys, you know, in New York City in 1980. And then some people found that too confining or too difficult, and they started doing a version of it with fantasy football that they invented from whole cloth. But the truth of the matter was, somebody invented a game that was basically the same game 18 years earlier. And we got the rules from one of the original participants who nobody had ever gotten the original rules, and we reached out to him, and he basically, I think, found them, looked them up, and retyped them and sent them to us. So I didn't, you know, it was an electronic document. So,
can I give you sport recommendations for your next book? Okay, pickleball.
We have references to pickleball in the book. You saw that, right? Because we do.
Which I, by the way, had not heard of until I saw the pickleball.
So you reference it. Sorry.
We do a pickleball paddle. We do a pickleball ball because we have a section, an illustrated section on all the balls of sports, and another illustrated section on all the paddles of sports.
Yes.
And so when we talk about the different paddles, we give a very short history as to what pickleball was. Pickleball was the one that was invented in the Pacific Northwest, right?
Yes, by a congressman. A congressman from Washington.
Oh, that we didn't know. We just knew it was just three dads.
Yes, they were on. One of them was a United States congressman. I think he was one. He was either in the Washington, congressman from Washington State.
It's funny, that didn't show up in any of the, you know, most of these things were back.
Yeah, go to the pickleball website.
Have you played it?
Yes. So I actually filmed a story on pickleball. And I went and I played. And it's really, you know now why it's so appealing, because
why is it called pickleball?
Okay, you want the story?
I do.
The senator's dog, who continued to pick up the ball, was named Pickles. So pickleball. And that's necessary.
By the way, he just went from being a congressman to being a senator.
He's going
to
be president by the
He's president.
A senator is a congressman.
It was,
right?
It was actually Gerald Ford who invented the game of pickleball. No, but pickleball's great because
it's our most athletic president. Gerald Ford.
Yes.
He played the highest level of competitive sports. He was an All-American center on the University of Michigan football team.
Perhaps if JFK didn't hurt his back, Richard Nixon was a bowler?
But by the way, maybe, but I'm just telling you that if you're playing Division I college football, Kennedy could have played all the football he wanted on his. He might have been an athletic person, but Gerald Ford played D1 football.
President Obama still plays pickup basketball.
He plays against the best players in the world.
Yes, and I'm sure they don't give him any room at all.
Well, he did play until the Secret Service gave him a hard time because he split his lip, and then they got too close to comfort. I don't know if he plays as much. Well, pickleball is cool because it's a combination of three sports. It's tennis, badminton, and ping pong. And it's great.
We all feel basically the same thing.
Yeah, but you play in a little section of a tennis court or outdoors, and it's great. You can play with all different levels, and it's very social and fun and growing quickly. And
all right, we'll get that one.
There's a couple of interesting sports that we came across. There's some Asian sport that involves, it's kind of like racquetball, but the ball is tethered. So it's tethered like by you, and somehow like there's a different level, and so you... I can't remember how it works, but we have it, and there's a video of it that it actually just looks. We make a reference to it in the book. It's just cool because it's like I wouldn't have thought to do that, like to tether the ball, and it sort of bounces back at you in a different way because it's also tethered. That's actually pretty cool. Like there's definitely, you know, I think the game that I'd love to that is to me the single most impressive athletic game is Tipak Sakra, which is this very popular game in Southeast Asia. It's essentially
It's volleyball.
It has a small wicker ball and a short net, and it's volleyball with your feet. So they all look like they're giving kung fu moves all the time because you can imagine, right? And you can, like, get on your hands and, you know, that, like, it's you just watch it. It's pretty cool. I would think it properly marketed, it could do well in America. Americans couldn't get off the ground. You have to be light.
Yeah. Right, you have to be very light. But see, there again, that would be a cool one to use to understand a culture. Right, understand how that game developed, and understand what it tells you about a culture that we might not be as.
Why were they interested in not using their hands in particular?
Right.
Soccer, there was just clearly like it was clear that there were all sorts of different games of football. It's funny, we go back and forth as to what was the most interesting fact we have in our book. Just sort of like, for me, it comes down to two. One is the idea that tennis, as we know it, existed because of the invention of the lawnmower, but the other one is that. Neil found this, which is that, so there were all sorts of games of football in England, just many, many different variations, they slowly began to sort of, you know, diverge on one issue, which is, can you use your hands or not? Is it just all football, or can you also carry the ball? And eventually there became a split, which is, you know, rugby went one way, and football went, you know, soccer went the other way. But Neil wrote this elegantly at some point in the book, but essentially it's more than likely that one of the things that is most seems the most basic to all sports, this idea that you take a rest, usually in the middle of the game, halftime, was a function of, we'll play with your rules the first, you know, for half the game, then we'll stop and we'll play with your rules the second half of the game.
Interesting.
That's what they think, that that's where half the game came from. And what's interesting about that is, of course, the whole idea of taking breaks, like breaks, I'm sure people took breaks, but the idea of sort of instituting it as a thing, halftime in basketball, in almost every sport, and volleyball there's not halftime, but like in soccer, and you know, that is just, that came from basically, it was come from rules. It was like, we'll play your way and then my way.
Here I was thinking that it was a group of soccer moms who wanted to make sure their kids had orange slices. Mm.
They were not an original constituent for the rules of soccer.
No, it was more barmaids.
They were not considered.
I like what you did there with the creating a family tree for sports. Now, you had a split that happened early on where you had rugby on one side and soccer on the other because people just simply couldn't agree on one set or standard of...
Well, that really was, you know, and that really was, you know, there were some sports, you know, there is a tree for certain sports, and that's very much, you know, the case. Like, you know, it goes, there was British football, then rugby, soccer, then from rugby developed two forms of rugby, you know, rugby union, rugby league, and probably from there Australian rules football, and then from rugby came American football, you know. So there definitely was one. But, you know, rare is the sport that comes out of nowhere. I think, you know, basketball specifically is probably the one that nobody doubts and that he claimed. He thought about other sports, but then he basically, you know, nobody basically had a game in which they were trying to sort of throw a ball into a basket.
Well, I've got your next book for you. We'll call it the sporting tree.
That you can have it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the time. Gary and Neil, thank you so much.
Oh, our pleasure.
Love the book on the origin of sports. And if you're not in the middle of writing a follow-up as we speak, hopefully I've given you some ideas for the...
We have a new book that we're working on, actually, for the next publisher.
You do? So,
yeah, we're already in the middle of it.
You talk about it, or...?
I think probably not. But I don't think they want us to. But okay. It's different than this.
I'll come back to the new offices.
Yeah, okay. It's fun. It's actually much more about the culture of sports, essentially.
Oh, good. Well, I look forward to that too.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
That's it for this edition of the Passport Play Podcast. My thanks once again to Gary Belsky and Neil Fine, whose new book on the origins of sports is available at booksellers everywhere. Don't forget to subscribe to the Passport Play Podcast on iTunes. Or by visiting passportplay.tumblr.com. Thanks for listening and talk to you again soon.